Well, we made it a dozen years or so ago through Y2K when everyone thought things were going to fall apart. And then just a few days ago, we made it through the Mayan calendar of December the 21st. It's really quite amazing the fascination that people have, the world have, Christians and non-Christians alike, the fascination that they have with the whole question of the end times. Just think of all the movies that are made that are apocalyptic movies, big disasters or disasters nearly avoided. Well, of course, a Christian's fascination is slightly different. Our fascination focuses in on the return of the King, the return of Jesus Christ. And the passage that we're going to look at today is very often read through those lenses. The lenses of the return of Christ, the lens of the end of the world. Now, it's a very, very difficult technical passage, and most of what it means is probably opposite to what we at first glance think it means. So today is one of those dreaded days where you can imagine yourself now sitting in a third year Bible college course, okay? It's not going to be a sermon, it's going to be a lesson, it's going to be kind of technical, it's going to be longer than normal, but I really think you need to pay attention because there's such an absolute misunderstanding of this passage in so many Christian circles. And so Sheena warned me, well, Alan, that might be fine. I said, how's it going to be? I said, well, it's going to be tough. She said, well, you keep it short because there's no use losing people after 10 minutes. I said, well, the problem is that it's so technical. There's just so much. So here's what I'm going to try to do. I'm going to try to give you enough that you can work your way through it and not so much that you get, oh, whatever. Because I'm going to tell you that the vast, vast majority, even all of this chapter, has nothing to do with the return of Jesus. And it's what I'm going to put forth to you is you're going to see all kinds of questions and what about this and what about that. I can't answer them all because never is a bit more true. I've told you before, my friend John Wilson said to me one time, Jones, why do you waste your good ideas on sermons? Don't do that. It's a waste of time. You can't develop them. You have to keep them for classes. But nobody comes to classes anymore, except, of course, you're all going to be there next Saturday on our Holy Spirit seminar. But besides that, so as a result, I have to give you as much as I can without knocking you off. But it's going to frustrate some of you, and you're going to have questions, and too bad for you. All right. This is a very controversial passage, because most people think that it's mostly about the return of Jesus. And then there are good scholars, there are D.A. Carson's in there. I mean, there's all kinds of good scholars that think that way, but there's all kinds of very, very bright and good scholars, for example, Rick Watts and Tom Wright, who will argue this has nothing, zero, not one iota, not one word to do with the return of Jesus, except for in perhaps a secondary fashion. Scott and I, they think it has to do with the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD by the Emperor Vespasian and really through his son, General Titus, that sacked Rome after a three-year siege. Scott and I disagree on this passage because Scott says it has nothing to do with the end times, and I think a little tiny bit at the end does. And we're debating it back and forth as late as Friday afternoon, 3 o'clock. We're still debating on this whole thing. We're certainly closer together than it first appeared. But if you want to hear the wrong interpretation, you can listen to Scott's sermon podcast. And he's saying the same thing about me. All right. Let's dive in. And I just, you know, you can choose. You can go have a nap now for about 45 minutes or so, or you can dive in. So whichever turns your crank. Well, let's see if we should be spending money on the Left Behind series and all the rest of it. Matthew chapter 24. It starts off with kind of the big question. Jesus left the temple, and as he was walking away, his disciples came up to him to call his attention to the buildings. They were beautiful. They were world-renowned for their beauty. Josephus compared it to snow-capped mountain as they looked at this marvelous building. Do you see all these things, he asked? Truly I tell you, not one stone here will be left on another. Every one will be thrown down. As Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives, it's just right opposite the temple, just a few feet away. As Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately. Tell us, they said, when will this happen, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? All right, Let me first remind you that chapter 24 of Matthew comes right after chapter 23 of Matthew. I know that that's a bit of a shocking revelation, but it's very fundamental and we need to understand that. And if you'll remember, really from chapter 21 through chapter 23, what Jesus does every once in a while, off and on, is that he brings a judgment against the temple and that whole system that's happening there. You know, there's the cleansing of the temple and the cursing of the fig tree, and then the end of chapter 23, you know, Jesus ends up saying, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, I've wept you, I've tried to gather you in, but your house is going to be left to you desolate. All of the ages of the sin, all the sin from the murder of Abel down through the last of the prophet, all of these things are going to come to judgment against this generation, against you. So chapter 23, Jesus says, you guys are toast. And so as they leave the temple, as they're walking down the hill, the disciples are looking around and they can't believe it because this temple is where God dwelt. It's the glory of Israel. It's this marvelous place. And they say, hang on, Jesus, we don't really get what you're talking about. Have you looked at how magnificent this place is? This is the dwelling place of God. This is where the Shekinah glory of God is. This is where all these marvelous things are. They can't believe it. So first you've got to remember, chapter 23 comes before chapter 24, and the end of chapter 23 is all about the destruction of the temple and the judgment of the practices of the temple and the end of the sacrificial system. Now, then we get into the disciples' question. And in one sense, the question is, are they asking one question, two questions, or three questions? Are they talking about one thing, two things, or three things? What in the world is going on? Well, in one sense, it's obvious that there are three questions, right? When will the temple be destroyed, these things you're talking about? What will be the sign of your coming? Your parousia, that's the word for coming, it means appearance. And it's the word that's used to describe when a king would come to the city in this great big parade. And all the dignitaries of the city and all the people, they would come out and meet him there. That was the king's parousia. And so when are you coming? When are you coming as a king? What's going to go on here? When are you going to appear? When are you going to appear? And thirdly, what will be the sign of the age? And so at first glance, we might think, well, it's obvious that there are three questions here, three different things, but we're forgetting that we're dealing with Jews that ask this question. You see, what we need to understand is that it would be absolutely inconceivable for these disciples to imagine that this temple would once again be destroyed without Jesus being on the throne and the day of judgment happening. It just wouldn't, they couldn't separate those different things. And there's all kinds of technical things we could get into about the language to show that. But for them, this is one issue. It's one big clump of an event. Destruction of the temple, return and enthronement of Jesus, his appearance, and the end of the age. It all to them wraps into one big thing. And they're all kind of saying, when's this one thing going to happen, Jesus? When is it going to happen? What is going to it look like? All of these sort of things. For them, it was one deal. Of course, we know that what happened was Jesus was crucified, buried, died, rose from the dead, ascended into heaven. Most of the world still didn't think he was the king. He hadn't been seen as the king. Second thing that happened is in 70 AD, the temple gets absolutely wrecked and destroyed and all of Jerusalem with it. And the third thing that happened is that we're still waiting for Jesus. So for them, everything was put into one big ball. For us, we got to figure out, how does this work out? Because these things happened across, 100 years and then really across a century. So what in the world is Jesus talking about and how does this work? Well, there's many options. But in very broad strokes, a couple of questions. First question. What's this passage about? Well, there's a couple of different options. Number one, it could be about the same one single event. It could be about either the destruction of Jerusalem or the return of Jesus Christ, the return of the King. So it could be about one subject. Or alternatively, it could be about two different events. It could be about the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD and also the return of King Jesus at some point. Okay, so it could be about one thing, it could be about two different things, and that's where the big debate is. If we're going to say, as some say, I would say probably the majority of scholarship says, with very, very staunch and notable exceptions, the majority would say, well, it's about two different things. It's about the destruction of Jerusalem, and it's about the return of Jesus. And if it's about two different things, then we've got another decision to make. We've got to decide, where does Jesus switch topics? And there's largely four different options that scholars go as to where Jesus changes topics. And you can kind of circle these in your Bibles. Some scholars say that Jesus switches topics in verse 9. And starting in verse 9, from there on in, he's talking about the return of Jesus. Others say, no, it's much later than that. It's verse 15. And from verse 15 on, which it gets kind of wilder in verse 15, you see the son, the abomination that causes desolation and so on. Other guys say, no, it's not verse 15. It actually is down here in verse 29. After the distress of these days, the sun will be dark and the moon will be given light. And that hasn't happened yet, and so it's going to happen. Another guy say, no, it's actually much further on. It's down there in verse 36. And then the rest say, no, it's all one topic. Let me come clean. I think it changes in verse 36. That's my opinion. Scott, as I said, believes it's all about the destruction of Jerusalem, that Jesus doesn't change topics, except for underlying, it's kind of a double prophecy, and we can learn some things about the return of Christ under it, but we better be careful how we say it. So just so you know, my bias. Now, it's very interesting because after I'd done all my study, I try to study each passage clean each time. So I did all my study and so on, came to my conclusions. And I went back when I last taught on this passage, which is in 1995. Yeah, I've been here for a little while, eh? And in 1995, I agreed with D.A. Carson and thought that he switched in verse 29. So, you know, early in my Christian life, I thought it was all about the return of Christ. So, you know, as each decade goes by, I get further and further. Maybe by the time I'm done, I'll think it's all Jerusalem. But just so you know, that's my bias. Okay. So that's the big question. And there are some of the options. So let's dig into the passage now as Christ goes. The first thing that Jesus does is he tells us some signs to ignore. He's going to outline some things. He says, I need you to understand that this has got nothing to do with what is going to happen. These are some signs that people are going to think it's a big sign to say that, you know, the end's coming, whatever. I just want you to know it's not. And now, we need to be very careful. Just before we get into the detail of it, let me just say this in general. What these words of Christ are prophetic, many of them apocalyptic language. Now, apocalyptic. See, this is where the time thing. Apocalyptic language, basically, it means a revelation, and it's more like looking at a painting than reading a technical book. Okay, that's kind of the difference. So prophetic and apocalyptic language, these are like word pictures that we need to be very, very careful that we don't try and make them concrete. One of the biggest mistakes we make as we exegete the Bible is that, especially with apocalyptic literature, people look at it and then they try and think, well, this is this and this is that and this horn is this and this eyeball is this and this is this. And it's dangerous to do that. So let me first say that. All right, let's take a look at some of these signs which Jesus says, ignore these. Verse 4. We're going to go 4 through 13. Jesus answered, watch out that no one deceives you. For many will come in my name, claiming I am the Messiah, and will deceive many. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you're not alarmed. Don't freak out. Don't think this is it. Ignore this sign. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. Nation will rise against nation, the kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these things are the beginning of the birth pains. Then you will be handed over and persecuted and put to death, and you will be hated by all the nations because of me. And at that time, many will turn aside from their faith, and they will betray and hate each other. And many false prophets will appear and deceive many, many people. Because of the increase of wickedness, the love of most will grow cold. But the one who stands firm to the end will be saved. And this gospel, the kingdom, will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all the nations, and then the end will come. Some signs to ignore. Number one sign, Jesus said, is ignore false messiahs. Now, when we think about the word Messiah, we think about Jesus because we call him Messiah, coming to save our souls, which even that is a question, but that's a whole other sermon. They didn't think about, you know, some guy coming to raise people from the dead. When they thought about Messiahs, they thought about some military guy coming to throw off Rome. And between the life of Jesus and 70 AD, when Jerusalem finally fell, there were all kinds of people leading rebellions. There was lots of, you know, 20,000 people were killed in this rebellion. And this guy led people out into the wilderness. And there's all of these people that maybe they didn't call themselves Messiah, but their followers certainly did. This is the King of the Jews. This is the one that's going to free us. And a rebellion would rise up and Rome would crush it. And there were all kinds of these guys before Jerusalem fell. So Jesus says, look, there's going to be all kinds of people that are going to come and promise you that I've got the answer. I'm going to throw off Rome. Follow me. Come out into the wilderness. You'll see. And then we'll rebel. We'll build this army. And away we go. And Jesus says, don't think that these guys are the Messiah or that this is the end. There's all kinds of them going to come. It is not the end. Just ignore it. First sign. Second sign. Ignore cultural conflict and geological upheaval. He says there's going to be all kinds of wars and rumors of wars. You know, how many of you are watching on TV, on the History Channel, they've got that Mankind, the story of us all. Have any of you seen that? They're these two-hour things, you know. And so Sheen and I sat down to watch it, and after about an hour of the first episode, I don't know how many there's going to be, Sheen gets up and leaves. She says, this is just all about war. And she walks away. And it's true. As you go through those episodes, all you see is the whole thing down throughout history is full of war. War for land. War because of riches. War because of science. War, 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 war. What Jesus is saying is, here's what you need to understand. As human beings, we know how to do one thing really, really well. We know how to kill each other. We know how to go over and try and take what somebody else has got. And it's just the natural course of events, he says. You need to understand that there's going to be all kinds of wars. And there's going to be all kinds of rebellions. And there's going to be all kinds of people being slaughtered. That's got nothing to do with what I'm talking about. It's just going to happen. And not only will there be political upheaval, but you know what? The earth is cooling. And so there's going to be earthquakes. And you're going to hear about all kinds of earthquakes. Had one just the other day. They got a 6-inch tsunami there on Vancouver Island. The killer. And Jesus says, these earthquakes, nothing to do with a sign. Ignore earthquakes. Always have happened, always will happen. Don't worry about it. Got nothing to do with what's going on. It's amazing how often this passage is used by putting together the news and people say, you know what, look how many wars there are, look how many earthquakes there are, boy, the end time must be coming. When what the whole passage is, when this stuff happens, don't worry about it, it's not the end. He says, this is the beginnings of the birth pangs. You know what that reminds me of? It's like my mum, when I'd get in trouble, my mum would say to me, because she had difficulty, 4 days I was with you, 4 days, agony of birth. You know. I said, well, mum, aren't I worth it? Anyway. So this whole deal, what Jesus is saying is, look, at the beginning, this stuff happens. They are signs to be ignored. They're not the signs of the destruction of Jerusalem, and they're certainly not the signs of the return of the coming of man. They are the natural cause of events in a broken, fragmented, sin-infested world. Next sign, persecution and apostasy. He says all kinds of people are going to fall away. And it really happened quite soon already by the book of Hebrews. You're reading of the church trying to decide when somebody goes away from the faith, can we let them back in? When somebody chickens out when persecution happens and then they want to come back into the church, do we let them in? And there's all this kind of struggle that goes on. He says, look, there's going to be all kinds of apostasy, all kinds of falling away. Some of them are going to fold under persecution. Some of them are going to fall because they're disappointed because they expected the king to come right away. Do you know in Thessalonica, you can read in the book of Thessalonians, that some of those guys quit work. I'm going to quit my job. Why? Well, I'm going to go out here. Jesus is coming back. Why would I work for that jerk? Jason? Jason? I'll have an explanation in our meeting tomorrow about that laughter. So I'll be right back, boom, and it didn't happen, and people fell away because it didn't happen within a few days. And so Jesus says, look, you need to understand there's going to be all of these apostasies, all of this disappointment, all of this thinking it's not turning out how I thought it was going to be. That's not a sign that's coming. Don't let these things bug you. Don't be deceived by these people that put up these signs, because they're not the signs of the end. Instead, through all of these difficult times, stand firm in your faith. Because that's what life is like on a sin-infested, sin-broken planet Earth, where people and nations and creation itself is afflicted and in need of healing. All right. So after he's done saying, don't worry about that stuff, it's got nothing to do, even though you think it is, it's got nothing to do with the coming, the end of the age. Got that, disciples? Yeah, okay, we got that. Well, now we get into the more controversial part. The part that I would say has to do with Jerusalem being destroyed. Pick it up in verse 14 again, because I disagree with where they make the paragraph break. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony for all the nations, and then the end will come. So when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation spoken through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let no one go to the housetop or go down and take anything out of the house. Let no one in the field go back and get their cloak. How dreadful it will be in those days for pregnant women and nursing mothers. Pray that your flight will not take place in the winter or on the Sabbath, because everything's closed, you can't buy supplies. For then there will be a great distress, unequal from the beginning of the world until now, and never to be equaled again. In those days had not been cut short, no one would survive, but for the sake of the elect, those days are going to be shortened. At that time, if anyone says to you, look, here's the Messiah, or there he is, do not believe it. False, I've told you the second time, tell you once, tell you twice, false messiahs and false prophets will appear and perform great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. See, I've told you ahead of time. So if anyone tells you there he is out in the wilderness, don't go out there. Or here he is in the inner rooms, don't believe it. For as lightning comes from the east and is visible in the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever there is a carcass, there the vultures will gather. Could be eagles. Vultures and eagles in that day and in that language, same word, and there's a big scholarly debate about whether it's eagles, and then from there they say, you know, what did the Romans have on top of their standards? They had an eagle, right? Immediately after the distress of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from the sky. The heavenly bodies will be shaken. Boy, it sounds nasty. Then will appear the Son of Man in heaven. Then will appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. And then all the peoples of the earth will mourn when they see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with the power and great glory. Just sang about that. And he will send his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from the one from the heavens to the other. Now learn the lesson of the fig tree. As soon as twigs get tender and its leaves come out, you know that summer is near. Even so, when you see these things, you know that it's right at the door. Truly, I tell you, this generation will certainly not pass away until these things have happened. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away. Trust me, this is going to happen. All right. We've had mild disagreements so far, but now we really get going. A lot of that stuff sounds an awful lot like the end of the world to me, Jones. Let's go through it. Verse 14. The gospel will go to all the nations, and then the end will come. I remember when I was in Bible college, you had all these missionaries would come in trying to recruit you. And I remember one guy in particular he opened his pitch by saying, how many of you guys want Jesus to come back? And of course everybody puts their hand up, and then he says, well, you know, Jesus can't come back until the gospel is preached in all the nations, so we should all be missionaries, go overseas and take the gospel. Kind of based on this passage. Because, you know, when the gospel is preached to all the nations, then Jesus is going to come back, is kind of the understanding. It's wrong. Because if you look at what the Bible says about the gospel being taken to all the nations, that's what the book of Acts is all about. It's about them going from Jerusalem, Judea, the very ends of the age. And we find that when Paul was in Thessalonica and the Jews got really upset with Paul and all the things that he was doing, this is what it says in Acts chapter 17. Listen to it carefully. Other Jews were jealous, so they rounded up some bad characters from the marketplace. They formed a mob and they started a riot in the city. They rushed to Jason's house in search of Paul and Silas in order to bring them out to the crowd because they're going to do nasty things to them. But when they did not find them, they dragged Jason and some other believers before the city officials, shouting, "These men who have caused trouble all over the world have now come here." They've taken the gospel all over the world. It's caused trouble all over the world. And now they've come here. And Jason was welcomed into his house, and they're all defying Caesar's decree, saying that there's one king, saying there's another king, one called Jesus. You go over into Colossians, for example. And here you've got the Apostle Paul writing to the Christians of Colossae. "If you continue of your faith, established and firm, and do not move from the hope held out in the gospel, this is the gospel that you have heard that has been proclaimed to every creature under heaven." I mean, Paul doesn't just talk about the nations. He's saying every creature under heaven has heard it, of which I, Paul, have become a servant. Are you getting a feeling for the language? This whole idea of the gospel being preached to the world, what the emphasis is that it's being taken to the nations beyond the Jews. That's what Jesus is trying to get across to these guys. Is that the gospel is going to break out of this whole idea that God only cares about his chosen people, the Jews. It's going to break out and the nations are going to be brought into the kingdom of God. It's going to go out into the whole world. And already, just a few decades later, Paul's writing in Colossians, hey, it's been taken all over the world. And the Jews in Thessalonica are saying, these guys have been all over the world preaching this gospel. So you can't use this passage to recruit missionaries. And he says, and then when that happens, the end will come. Well, so far, the only end that he's been talking about is the destruction of Jerusalem. And Paul wrote those things about in Colossians, and we have that record in the book of Acts, well before 70 AD, before Jerusalem was destroyed. And so that whole thing in verse 14 there, I want to argue, has more to do with that the gospel is going to spread before 70 AD. Than it has to do with the gospel is going to go to every nation before Christ can return. Second thing, verse 15. Wow, now we're starting to get tricky. Verse 15. When you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation spoken through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand, then those in Judea flee to the mountains, blah, blah, blah. Jesus is talking about a prophecy given by Daniel, who lived, you know, in 600 and some BC. And the first fulfillment of this prophecy pretty much happened in 67 BC. Okay? 67 years before Christ. When Antiochus Epiphanes understood that Jerusalem was rebelling. So he sent in the troops to sack Jerusalem. They got into the temple. They set up a statue of Zeus or Jupiter in the Holy of Holies, and they slaughtered a sow on the altar. Because they understood that that's the most profane thing that you could do. And so that was the first fulfillment of that prophecy way back in Daniel back there. And Jesus saying, you know what, something worse than what they did, what Antiochus Epiphanes did is going to happen. So what in the world is it? Well, there's a few different options. The first option, some would argue, well, what's going to happen is the temple is going to be rebuilt, and you know that there's this whole movement to rebuild the temple and get some money together and get rid of the dome there and all that stuff. And then when the temple's being rebuilt, the nations are going to gather around. There's going to be the big war, right? And all the nations are going to come against Jerusalem. And somewhere there, the Antichrist is going to set up an abomination of desolation. And then after that happens, Christ is going to turn. And it's going to be the end. So that's one interpretation. I disagree with that interpretation for many, many reasons, not the least of which is I don't think the temple is going to be rebuilt, but I might be wrong. Second option. An abomination that causes desolation in Israel was any affront to the true worship of God. And when you do an Old Testament word study of the abomination that causes desolation, throughout the genre of the Old Testament, throughout the different types of scriptures, from the prophets to the law to the history, whenever you see this combination of words, it overwhelmingly, almost always has to do with abominations that Israel does by their false worship, by their refusal to worship God in the way that they should. If you want to talk about the biblical language of what an abomination that causes desolation is, it's the false worship of Israel to other gods and in other means. And so what they're saying is that, look, you need to understand, Jesus is saying, is that when you reject me, when you fail to understand that I am the Messiah, when you fail to understand that it is through me that you worship God, when you fail to understand that I am the ultimate sacrifice for sins, past, present, and future, when you don't recognize who I am, when you will continue to worship God in this way that is done, and you refuse to say who I am, that is an abomination of worship, and it's going to cause the desolation. The temple is going to get wrecked, because the temple has only, in all the times it was destroyed, it only happens when Israel abandons God. It can never happen while Israel is faithful to God, but now you're not worshiping God anymore. You reject me, so this temple is going to be destroyed. Why? Because your worship, your refusal to accept me is an abomination against God. And so Jerusalem is going down. The third option is that the abomination that causes desolation is something that happened right at 70 AD when the Romans came, kind of ill-defined, and there's a whole bunch of arguments about what is the holy place. Is it Israel? Is it Jerusalem? Is it the holy, holy? I mean, we could spend a long time fighting our way through that. But the idea is that it could have been when the Zealots desecrated the temple before the Romans got there in about 68. There's all kinds of things that could be, and that's the third option, is that the abomination that causes desolation is the Romans coming with their eagles, with their standards, setting them up in Jerusalem, destroying and sacking Jerusalem. I want to say I probably lean towards number two. But he says, when you see the abomination, and remember he's talking to the disciples, and he's saying that this generation is going to see this happen. We'll talk about generations in a bit, I think. Third thing, C, verses 16 through 29. He warns about a sudden, a fast, and a terrible destruction. And they did. The Romans came in and they destroyed the temple. They cast not one stone left upon another. As a matter of fact, I've got a picture of it. They're still laying there. When those of us that went to Israel will remember. Remember we walked past, went to the Wailing Wall, and we walked down this thing, and here's all these rocks piled up that were cast down by the Romans. And they leave them there as rubble to remind them that this is what happened to our temple. And so that's what they did. And it was an incredibly terrible, terrible thing. Verse 21 says, "For then there will be great distress, unequaled from the beginning of the world until now, and never to be equaled again." Well, that doesn't sound like just the wrecking of a city, Jones. Never to be equaled again. That sounds like maybe the end of the world. But I want you to listen to some of Josephus's account of the destruction of Jerusalem. Now, do you know who Josephus is? Okay, Josephus was a Jew, but he was basically a turncoat. And he sort of tried to bridge the gap between Rome and the Jews. He tried to say to the Romans, the Jews, my people aren't that bad, it was just the rulers that were bad. And he tries to say to the Jews, you know what, Rome is the vengeance of God coming. Okay, and he exaggerates and he twists the truth. But he is one of the foremost, you know, he lived through that time of the destruction of Jerusalem. So his stuff is one of our primary sources, okay? I want you to just listen to his description of the destruction of Jerusalem. I'm not going to read it all, but I'm going to give you the flavor of it. They get, after 3 years of siege, they built these ramparts, blah, blah, blah. They get in there. When they went into the numbers of the lanes of the city with their swords drawn, this Romans, they slew those whom they overtook without mercy, and they set fire to the houses, so smoke billowed up and blocked the sun, and the moon looked red, just like when the forest fire. He doesn't say that. That's my little commentary. And he set fire to the houses, whither the Jews had fled. So the people run into the houses, and set fire to them, and they burnt every soul in them, burned them alive. And he laid waste a great many of the rest. And when they came to the houses to plunder them, they found entire families of dead men and the upper rooms of dead corpses, that is, of such as died by the famine, because they were under siege. And they stood in horror at this sight. These are hardened Roman soldiers, stood in horror at the sight. And they went out without touching anything. But although they had this commiseration for those who were destroyed in that manner, yet they had not the same for those who were still alive. But they ran everyone through whom they met with, and obstructed the very lanes with their dead bodies. So many people dead in the streets, you couldn't get down the streets anymore. They killed so many. And he made the whole city run with blood to such a degree, indeed, that the fire of many of the houses was quenched with men's blood. They set fire to the houses, but there was so much blood in the streets, it put the fires out. Maybe a bit of an exaggeration, but you get the idea. Then after they got some captured, but of the young men, he chose the tallest and most beautiful and reserved them for the triumph. The triumph is a parousia. It's when the king or the emperor or the general would appear at the Roman city gates, and they would have this triumph, and they would take some of their captives in there, the best looking guys, and they'd slaughter them in front of the people. And for the rest of the multitude that were above 17 years old, he put them in bonds and sent them to the Egyptian mines, slaves. Titus also sent a great number into the provinces as a present to them, so that they might be destroyed upon their theaters by the sword and by wild beasts. That's the Colosseums, right? But those that were under 17 years of age were sold for slaves. Now, the number of those who were carried away captive during this whole war was 97,000. One they took, one they didn't take. As was the number of those that perished during the whole siege, 1,100,000. And finally, now, this vast multitude is indeed collected out of remote places because it's Passover, and so the Jews were all in there. That's where they got trapped. But the entire nation was now shut up as by fate in a prison. That's Josephus saying God brought this judgment on them. And the Roman army encompassed the city all around with the eagles. When it was crowded with inhabitants, accordingly, the multitude of those that were in perish exceeded all the destruction that either man or God had ever brought upon the world. Same language. Same language. Worst thing that had ever happened and ever would happen again. The abomination or its desolation, the fast and terrible destruction, all about destruction of Jerusalem. How are you guys doing? 7:05. 7 minutes after. Don't waste your good ideas on sermons. Well, you can leave if you want. I'm going to keep going. Okay, what about this riding on the clouds? That's pretty obvious. I've seen the King of Glory riding on the clouds. Okay, well, let's take a look at that. What's he doing there? What he's doing there is, again, he's returning to the prophet Daniel. And he's bringing up some imagery from the prophet Daniel. And here's what it is. Daniel chapter 7, look at it carefully. In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was one like the Son of Man. Right, that's the Son of Man. Who is the Son of Man? One like the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days. Who's the Ancient of Days? Father, right? He approached the Father and was led into his presence. He was given authority and glory and sovereign power. All nations and peoples, all authority has been given to me. All nations and peoples of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. Talking about Jesus. Now, here's the question. Here's the big question. Which direction is Jesus going when he's riding on the clouds? Look at the passage. You tell me, which direction is he going? Up or down? You have to say it because you've got to commit yourself. Which direction is he going? Up. Up. Not down. Not coming to earth. Not saying this is the end. Not the whistle blow, everybody's out of the pool, it's all over. Up. 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 to the Ancient of Days. You see, what Jesus is talking about is he's saying that the Son of Man is going to go from earth to heaven. This is his ascension. And here's the deal. It's the vindication and the demonstration that his suffering was not in vain. That's what this passage is talking about. Jesus saying, I am going to be vindicated. I am going to be seen as the Messiah. You are going to see that everything I say is true. This temple is going to be destroyed. I'm going to rise from the dead. All these things. You see, what demonstrates the vindication of Jesus? Well, there's several different things that we say. This is showing that Jesus is true. Number one, his resurrection and ascension. They tried to kill him, but God raised him from the dead. We see that in scriptures, right? Number two, the destruction of the temple and those who opposed him. Jesus said, you know what? Your house is going to be left to desolate. I'm going to go out. I'm going to cleanse the temple. Why? Den of robbers. And I'm going to go out. I'm going to curse the fig tree. Why? Because this temple is going to be done. And now I'm going to tell you that this is all going to happen. Number three, the news of Jesus' victory would spread through all the world, through his followers. And we see angels in the passage. And we think about, you know, furry winged guys. Well, first of all, that's more like seraphim, and they've got several wings and eyes and stuff, so we'll leave that aside. Angels, really, the word angel, it just means messenger. And so it probably is not, you know, fluttering guys gathering people from the corners of the earth. It's the messengers of the gospel that Jesus has been vindicated, going to all of the nations and bringing them into the kingdom of God. It's the messengers of the gospel. It's you. That's me. Today and back then, before 70 AD and all these things came true, it was the apostles and their followers that were dispersed throughout the world. And finally, he's vindicated by his ascension to the right hand of God. And we say, there he is. Look, he's at the right hand of God. He's ascended on high. He was right. He is the Lord. He is King. So, seasons and generations, 32 through 35. Man, basically what he's been saying so far is all of these are not signs. You're not going to be able to figure it out. Just understand when you see Rome get worked up, get out of the room. Don't let any nationalism or loyalty to the temple or any of that stuff hold you back. Get out. Verse 34, this generation. Now, this is a bit of an issue because if it's not talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, people have to figure out, well, what do you mean this generation will not pass away before these things? If it's talking about the end of the world, what's this generation? So some people say, well, you know, it's the nation of the Jews, or it's this type of people, wicked people. I want to say that it's this generation. Within 40 years, within the people that were alive and Christ spoke these words, are going to see the destruction of Jerusalem. So I want to argue that all the way through, right down here to verse 35, it's all about the destruction of Jerusalem and not the return of Jesus. Then we get into verse 36, and this is where Scott and I part ways. About that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angel of heaven or the Son, but only the Father. As it was in the days of Noah, so will be at the coming of the Son of Man. For in the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage up to the days of Noah and entered the ark. And they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them away. This is how it's going to be with the coming of the Son of Man. Two men will be left in the field, one will be taken to the left, two women will be grinding with a handmill, one will be taken, one will be left. Therefore, keep watch, because you do not know on what day your Lord will come. But understand this, if the owner of the house had known at what time of night the thief was coming, he would have kept watch and would not have let the house be broken into. So also you must be ready, because the Son of Man will come at an hour when you do not expect him. If you're going to go with the argument that this is all about Jerusalem, then this coming of the Son of Man, that is the coming that we just read about to heaven and his vindication. Okay, so that's how that ties in together. I happen to think that he's talking now about the return of Jesus. A couple of reasons for that. He talks about that day, and it seems to me I agree with Richard France, who says that when he says that day, he's making a distinction between that day, the return of Christ, and everything that he's talked about before. Secondly, all of a sudden we have in verse 36 and following the return of this word parousia, the return of this word Jesus' appearance, Jesus' coming. So for those two reasons, I kind of think he switches topics here, but I'm okay if you want to say it's the destruction of Jerusalem. The main thing that Jesus is saying in this passage is be ready. We're going to talk more about this next week. But he's basically saying, look, in the days of Noah, they weren't expecting it. They needed to be ready. You be ready. You be ready. Well, there's all kinds of debate there. So let me just give you some solid answers. Don't worry, I'm just about done. What in the world can we say for sure? I mean, obviously, this is kind of, whoa, this guy and this guy and this guy, maybe this, maybe that. What do we know for sure? Number one, tough times don't mean that Jesus is coming, that the end is at hand. There was wars and rumors and wars and earthquakes back then, and there is today, and there will be tomorrow. B, carry on the mission in the midst of difficulty. Did you notice the emphasis on kingdom work throughout it? Stand firm. Don't be deceived. Take the word to all the nations. Get out there. You see, we can become so enamored and so distracted by the difficulties of the world, and it can become so disheartening, and we can become, whether it's our own life or whether it's the world, and we just can't. No, and Jesus said, no, you need to understand. Get out there and take the word. Continue the mission. See, Jesus is vindicated and can be trusted. You know, it's very interesting to me. Did you notice there that he talks about, see, I have told you so, verse 25. And what he's saying is, look, understand, I'm telling you, this is going to happen. I know it's going to happen. I am in control. I am your hope. Hold close to me through all of these difficult times. I can be trusted. I'm telling you this is going to happen, and it's going to look to you like everything's gone to pot. It hasn't. This is all in the order of what we, as Father, Son, and Spirit, know is going to happen. Number four. Live lives of readiness. That's really the whole point here to this last bit about Noah. We all think we have time. I'll get closer to Jesus tomorrow. I'll share the gospel with my best friend tomorrow. I'll get this straightened out in my life tomorrow. Tomorrow, 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 tomorrow. And Jesus is saying, you know what? You might not get tomorrow. Hopefully you will. But destruction might come across your city, might come across your car, you're driving down the highway, Christ might return. And the whole thing in this end is this, whether it's talking about all the destruction of Jerusalem or Christ return, whatever it is, what he's saying is, live lives of readiness. Put the kingdom first. Share the gospel. Get right with Christ. Be filled with the Spirit. Be ready. So that's it. There's my heresy for the day. Father, you know, I just want to thank you for your word. And we find it confusing at times and get into these details. And we just touched the surface this morning on this incredible passage. But we know that Christ is vindicated. We know that we need to live lives of readiness, because you are coming back. And so, Lord, fill us with your Spirit so that we can live these lives. In Christ's name, amen.